Accession number 28410, Reel 6.
Below the fort of...
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Ken Blyth in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 16th of the 8th, 2005, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Ken, can we continue to talk about your experience in relation to the Syrian campaign and how your experience of it would wind up, or how it would wind up for you?
Well, at the time of the armistice, I had a gun position in the valley below the fort of Merjayoun. And when we were notified that the armistice had been completed, we moved as a troop up the valley to a location in the north where we were camped near a rather pleasant flowing stream in which most of us had a good wash for the first time for some weeks. While here, in conjunction with another sergeant from our battery, we climbed an adjacent mountain and found a cairn of stones on the top, which had been erected by subsequent by previous climbers, mostly apparently men serving in either the Foreign Legion or the French forces in Syria. At this point in time, back in the gun emplacement, we were allowed to take one of our tow trucks and went on leave one day to Damascus, which was rather interesting in that we were allowed to take our arms with us. And Damascus, of course, was occupied by French forces as well as the normal civilians. It was an interesting day.
What was Damascus like?
A very ancient city. And the first city in Damascus where we had been able to enter shops or anything of that nature. We didn't spend a great deal of time there, as we had to drive back to our bivouac site. But subsequently, I was given permission to take a leave party without arms to a place called Ailey, which is spelled A-L-E-Y. At the time, the pronunciation, as I heard it, suggested to me that the place I'd been given leave to was Zahle, which is Z-A-H-L-E. And so I took my troop on leave to Zahle. This was a very interesting town in the mountain area on the way to Beirut, which had some interesting cafes with a channel of icy cold water running through under the tables into which you placed your beer bottle or wine bottle, depending on what you had been able to buy. It was during this leave visit that Australian and British troops got involved in a few brawls in the city or town without any real disastrous consequences, except that a British officer was calling out for whoever was in charge of the Australians to get his troops out of the town to stop the brawling. It was rather impossible to go round and round up troops who were spread all over the place. So it eventually finished up with our troops assembling after their leave finished and going back to the bivouac without any bother. We then moved into the hills outside Beirut to a village called Dur Shuar. It was a summer tourist resort of the French population of Beirut. It was a very delightful summer village. We were bivouacked on vineyard terraces and spent our time enjoying the pleasures of being able to shop in local cafes, etc., in the area, and also were able to get leave with a transport vehicle to drive down into Beirut, which was a very pleasant city in those days, with very good restaurants and whilst I was only on leave a couple of times, I do believe, if I remember rightly, going to some horse races one day somewhere in the area. Not long after this, I received a signal from artillery headquarters ordering me to proceed to the AIF, that's the Australian Imperial Forces Middle East School of Artillery, at a place called New Surat in the south of Gaza in Palestine, where I was to fulfil the duty of an anti-tank gunnery instructor at the school. I went by vehicle via Haifa down through Palestine and Gaza to the school, where I discovered that they had requested that an officer be sent from the anti-tank regiment as an instructor, and for some reason or other they had sent me as a sergeant. Here at the school I was an instructor in anti-tank gunnery, mostly using what was called a porte-mounted two-pounder gun. In other words, the gun was mounted on the top of a four-wheel drive truck. But in addition, I instructed in the 25-pounder field gun and the 150mm First World War howitzers, which arrived from Fort Worth in Texas, I think it was, in the United States, still with grease from the preservation of them from the First World War, covering the working parts of the guns. Our gunnery range was located in the Sinai Desert, And in marking out a gunnery range using 40-gallon drums filled with sand with a flag on them, we made the discovery on a subsequent day when we went out to do the shoot that the drums had been very carefully moved by Bedouin Arabs, thinking we had buried something of value under them, so that our artillery range was rather a little bit out of plumb as far as the coordinates of the drums were concerned, so we had to resurvey in order to ensure where we were shooting. Not long after limited service in the AIF Middle East School of Artillery, all the instructional schools in the area were joined together at an infantry school where we were involved in fairly extensive infantry training to fill in time prior to our move back to Australia. At this point, I was withdrawn from the school and posted for special duties to a transport unit to drive a large diesel truck through the Sinai Desert and along the Suez Canal to Tewfik for loading onto a ship there for return to Australia. I did a number of these trips, and eventually the whole of the School of Artillery staff, together with units from the Signal School, boarded a ship called the Dorset to return to Australia. The Dorset was a small refrigerated cargo vessel which had, on its previous voyage, brought tanks from the Great Britain to the Middle East, many of which had broken loose in the holds during a storm in the Bay of Biscay and severely damaged the sides of the ship, allowing water to wash in and as well to damage the refrigeration pipes and pulverized cork, which was used as insulation, so that the decks in the holds of the ship in which we were quartered were covered with this mass of powdered cork, which had a rather unpleasant smell. And when we came down the companionways, we would have to watch carefully to see whether the cork was moving, which indicated that there was water underneath it, so that we didn't step into water through the cork. We were accommodated in hammocks above this material for the trip back to Australia. We travelled unescorted, and the staff of the School of Artillery manned the ship's guns, which included a large caliber gun on the stern of the ship and assorted other armaments, including an Oerlikon cannon on top of the bridge. I used to man this Oerlikon cannon, regardless of weather conditions, for so many hours a day or night, as the case may be, on what was basically an anti-submarine watch. the number of people on board the ship was quite large, and the catering was limited to the provision of hot water for tea making on a small structure put up on the deck to act as a kitchen. And apart from making tea, they also boiled up tinned potatoes, and the remainder of our meals by and large consisted of tinned bully beef and a rather large square biscuit called a Timaru biscuit, which could have been mistaken for a small floor tile in today's terms. This was broken up into pieces and softened with tea during the meals on the trip.
When was it that you were returning back to Australia?
This would have been around about probably April, I would think, in 1942.
Was it disappointing to be leaving the desert?
No, we were quite excited about going back to Australia, as we were later told by the ship's captain, that we would be in Fremantle on roughly a certain date, or we wouldn't be there at all, as we had no escort. So we travelled completely blacked out at night with a diesel ship that indicates its presence with an incredible display of fireworks from the exhaust gases of the very much overdue for service engines on the ship. On arrival in Fremantle in West Australia, we were told that we had, if I remember rightly, about 12 hours leave, that a steam train would take us up to the town of Perth free of charge, and that any hotel in Perth would give us a towel and a cake of soap and free use of their bathroom to get ourselves cleaned up, and the first drink would be free on the house. Needless to say, by the time we arrived back in Fremantle to rejoin our ship that night, most of us were very clean, very well fed, and substantially inebriated. For the journey round to Adelaide, where we were finally to disembark at the port there, most of us seemed to have touches of diarrhea. And I had not mentioned earlier, but the toilet facilities on the ship consisted of a plank arrangement on one side of the ship, on which you squatted, hanging on to a rope to use as a toilet direct into the ocean. We didn't lose anybody falling overboard using this. The only peculiar thing about it was that when we arrived in Adelaide, that particular side of the ship was against the wharf, and the waterside workers, who were rather subject to union direction, refused to unload the ship for about 3 days for some reason or other, and the temptation for us to turn our guns towards the people on the wharf who wouldn't unload the ship was very strong, but didn't eventuate. So ultimately we were unloaded and moved. Many of the people on the ship were moved into accommodation in private homes in Adelaide. The Middle East School of Artillery staff were quartered at a race course in the Adelaide area called, I think it was, I've forgotten the name of the place now. And while there, instead of getting town leave, we were, at least I was instructed, to run an anti-tank school for a local anti-tank regiment. And it was during this exercise, after we'd been out for a shoot along the beach somewhere near Glenelg, that one of our truck drivers shot ahead of the rest in order to try and ask the CO if they could pull out and go for lunch somewhere, that the truck overturned and one or two of the people on it were killed, and it became necessary for me to take steps to look after the injured, call for ambulances and recover the truck.
On your return to Australia, people talk of the civilian life being a strange scenario. Given that you'd experienced action in Syria and you'd seen another part of the world, what was it like to come back to Australia?
Well, we didn't, or at least I didn't, see much of civilian life because I became involved in this course for the local anti-tank regiment, which precluded me from having leave into the town of Adelaide. So I was stuck at Warradine, I think it was, race course, giving lectures or demonstrations. And then I was given a further movement order, being the only anti-tank person in the school. I was placed on a flat-top railway wagon with my vehicle and gun and assorted armaments, etc., and given some hard rations and a lot of documentation, and told that I was to proceed to a place called Pakapunyu. I had no idea where Pakapunyu was, and other than that, it was somewhere in Victoria.
What did you, I mean, presumably you were being given this job because you'd experienced action. What did that feel like, to know that you'd actually been in action?
Well, I felt a lot safer because I wasn't in a position where I had to be always aware or conscious of the fact that at any time somebody might start shelling us with artillery shells or sniping at us with machine guns or other weapons of destruction. The feeling back in Australia initially was rather exciting because we had become so used to driving on the right-hand side of the road in the Middle East that from the port where we disembarked in Adelaide, there were a large number of accidents with army vehicles which continued to drive on the right-hand side of the road where they should have driven on the left. This problem, of course, was quickly overcome. When travelling on the flat-top railway wagon, we pulled into Spencer Street Station in Melbourne. I noticed that across the road from the station was a large hotel called the Alexandra Hotel, or a very similar name. I checked with the engine drivers and to find out how long we were going to be at this station, and arranged that they wouldn't go without me, and I went over to the hotel and asked them if I could use the bathroom to have a shower and get cleaned up. I think, if I remember rightly, this cost me a shilling, and the requirement at law was for hotels to provide travellers with such a facility so that I was allowed to go up and use this. Then going back onto the train took the thing through to a town called Albury on the border between Victoria and New South Wales. I got my gun and truck, etc., off there to find that I then had to drive back to a town called Seymour, which was a little more than halfway back to Melbourne, because they didn't have facility there for unloading me. And so I eventually drove this vehicle back to the town of Seymour and then out to Puckapunyal and to the army training area there where the Australian anti-tank school was. Here I became something of a novelty, as I was the first instructor with overseas, shall we say, battle experience, and among other things was lent for a few days to the American 1st Tank Destroyer Battalion, who were stationed then in Seymour. This was an American Army regular unit. They had small 37mm anti-tank guns, which were about as useless as our two-pounders.
Where were you when the Japanese entered the war on December 7,
41? I would have been in New Surat, south of Gaza, at the artillery school in Palestine.
What was the feeling then to know that not only were you at war with Germany and Italy, but that you were now at war with Japan?
Naturally, all Australians were anxious to get back to Australia to become part of the local war effort. My original unit, the 2nd Anti-Tank Regiment, came back to Australia on board a ship which first called at Bombay, I think it was the Mauritania, and then they later transferred to a ship called the Egra, which sailed around the Indian Ocean until the powers that be, Churchill or Curtin or someone, decided whether they were going to go to Burma or Australia. Ultimately, they came back to Australia and disembarked in Adelaide and then moved by rail to northern New South Wales, and subsequently went to New Guinea and were at Milne Bay and Oro Bay, then came back to Australia, and then later took part in the invasion of Borneo at Balikpapan, by which time they were equipped with 6-pounder anti-tank guns and 4.5-inch mortars.
What was the reputation of the Japanese prior to Pearl Harbor?
Well, I don't think many of us had given much thought to the Japanese. I don't think we had any idea prior to Pearl Harbor of the extent to which they had built up an enormous combat army and navy, particularly navy.